You probably didn't even hear me say that, but I said good morning. Well, let's try it again. Good morning, church.
Good morning.
Oh, see, you did hear me that time. It is good to be here with you. It's good to be indoors today. I actually saw a few snowflakes earlier this morning. I was kind of shocked at how cool it had gotten. It has become, or getting close to being, well and truly winter time. We went out, several men I know went out yesterday to help at Barbara and Lee Knox's house. I'm thankful to be a part of a congregation where the men are willing to sacrifice some of a limited free time to go and work that way. And it was just it was really neat to see that. Good to see the benefits of those efforts. It did rain a little bit the night before, so of course, out on Wayside Drive, we did most of it in canoes, but still, it was good to get that done, and good to see Miss Barbara and Mr. Lee. So thankful for that. It is also, as you've been watching, football season's kind of continuing on, and we've gotten all the way to the World Series, which is between the Dodgers and the Astros, another thing that lets us know, we're progressing here towards the end of fall, heading in towards winter. And as a native Texan, I've always sort of pulled for the Astros. As a kid, in my room on my wall, I had a poster of the first baseman for the Astros, Mr. Glenn Davis. Of course, you all know Glenn Davis well. He looked different back then, but anyway. I also had a picture of one of their pitchers, their best pitcher at the time, was a guy named Mike Scott. Had that on my wall. My first major league game to ever go to was in the old Astrodome, and I remember my dad had gotten tickets through a friend of his in Texarkana, and we were on the mezzanine right behind home plate in the Astrodome, and I had one of those rainbow striped jerseys. We were cheering on Jose Cruz, and it was a great thing. So I've always sort of been an Astros fan, but I have to confess that there for a time during that era, my favorite player in all of baseball was Mr. Mike Socha. Now, some of you may not remember Mike Socha, but he was the catcher for the Dodgers back in the late 80s, and I was a catcher at the time in Little League Baseball because I couldn't run. And so And it was, you just let the ball hit you, and it stopped. And so I was a good catcher. So I wanted to grow up and be the best catcher, too, like Mike Socha, just like Mike Socha, because I thought he was just the best in the league. So I was pulling for the Dodgers the last time they were in the World Series, or the last time they won the World Series, which was in 1988. And I still remember what is perhaps one of the greatest World Series moments of all times. It was just the first game of the World Series, but it was the ninth inning. The Dodgers were down 4-3 to the Oakland Athletics. They were down to their last out, as a matter of fact. And so Tommy Lasorda calls for an unexpected pinch hitter, and it's Kirk Gibson. Now, Kirk Gibson spent most of his career with the Detroit Tigers, and he was a really good hitter. But he was older at this stage in his career, and he was injured. And so he was not expected to play at all. But nonetheless, Kirk Gibson is called up as a pinch hitter, and he just basically limps to the plate. He is barely, it looks like he's barely able to walk, much less run, so you don't know, even if he hits the ball, what's he going to do, because he's not very mobile. He gets down, and he's facing none other than Dennis Eckersley, who is the best closer in all of baseball at that time. And gets down, he's down to two, he's got two strikes on him when he hits the game-winning home run with perhaps the ugliest swing you have ever seen, the most unlikely of swings to hit a home run. And there he was, and he just sort of half-jogged, half-trotted, limped around the bases, exuberant, and the Dodgers won that first game and went on to win the series. It was an unbelievable, unpredictable sort of comeback. And there are other great comebacks in sports. Just, some of the greatest comebacks in the history of sports. The Red Sox were down 3-0 in the series against the Yankees in the American League Championship Series. And they came back to be the first team ever. I know He's really excited about me bringing this up over here. I was not targeting you with this. But the first team ever to be down 3-0 and come back and win the best of 7 series. The Duke Blue Devils trailed Maryland by 22. Maryland had jumped out to a 39-17 lead in the first half of the final four, their final four game in 2001. But by the final horn, Duke had mounted a 95-84 comeback victory. And then there's the game that's just known simply as the comeback. And I remember this one. This one ripped my heart out a little bit. The Buffalo Bills had fallen behind 35-3 in the second half of their game against the Houston Oilers. But the Bills quarterback, Frank Reich, threw 4 touchdown passes to lead the Bills to a 41-38 victory. And a comeback is an amazing thing to do, as most sports fans know. But you also know, if you're sports fans, that most of the time, like 90-whatever percent of the time, comebacks fall short. They just don't come through. He almost came back. It was so close. We came back and made it a close game, just shy of getting that victory. And how many times has your team been down and mounted this comeback, and they get close, and then they still don't win? And so you'd think, after all these crushing defeats, that we'd learn to give up by now. Because it happens more often than not. You just end up losing. But there's something in us that just loves a good comeback. It's not just in sports. We love it when we see comebacks in life. You know, in the entertainment business, when Tina Turner comes back and in the latter stages of her career is resurgent. Johnny Cash, even Elvis Presley had a comeback in 1968. In business, in 1985, Apple fired Steve Jobs from the company that he had founded. But he came back to reshape what is now the most valuable company on the planet. We love personal comeback stories, people who have overcome addiction or personal failure to land a great job, to build their family, to benefit their communities and their churches and the people they know and love. And maybe this morning you're thinking that you're just about due for a comeback. Maybe you're thinking of your health or your finances, or your employment, or a relationship with a loved one. You just think, boy, I really could use a comeback. But for a few minutes this morning, I want you to think even bigger picture than those things. And those are pretty big picture. But I want you to think about your relationship with God. Now, I know the odds are long. Believe me, I know that. And I know you've fallen behind like I've fallen behind at times, and perhaps you've even given up on yourself. You think you don't even want to embarrass yourself by trying again, by coming out in the second half from the locker room. But somewhere inside of you, there's still a voice that whispers, maybe, just maybe. And so you sort of dare to hope again. And if that's you, this next few minutes are going to be really important for you, because this is your story. It's my story. It comes from the 19th chapter of the book of Isaiah. Just to kind of bring you up to date on what's going on here. At one time, here's the southern kingdom of Judah's down here. The northern kingdom of Israel was up here. All this green is the Assyrian Empire. Now, right here you see that in 745 B.C., it was much smaller. It wasn't that big a threat. But under their new leadership, they had this sort of really aggressive campaign. And they'd taken over almost all the north, including the anti-Assyrian leaders. There was a sort of anti-Assyrian pact that was going on up here to the north. It was Israel and Aram, who was right in here. And Assyria had come down and just sort of wiped them out. And here's the next front right here. And this is where Isaiah is prophesying from. And so they're thinking, how are we going to defeat this mighty empire? Well, the leader of the anti-Assyrian resistance was now right down here in Egypt. And so it would be logical, it would totally make sense if Judah, the southern kingdom, teams up with Egypt and perhaps together they could thwart Assyria's mighty army. That's the main target here, is to stop Assyria. Now, one time Judah had formed an alliance with Assyria. They were the ones who talked Assyria into coming down and taking over Israel and Aram. But now they've realized just this dangerous playmate that they've made, and that this playmate is not going to be content with just the northern part. They're going to come down and take over Jerusalem as well. So they're looking anywhere for allies. Egypt seems to be the best resource. And Egypt had three things going for them. Three reasons why you would think Egypt would be a great ally in the battle against Assyria. Number one, they had a good religion. They had an established religion that had been around forever. Powerful gods was the thinking at the time. Number two, they had resources. And number three, they had reason. So they had religion, resources, and reading. That's the three R's that we're going to try to remember this morning. And in the first 15 verses of Isaiah chapter 19, God dismantles all three of those. So beginning in verse 1, we read in Isaiah 19, "See, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and is coming to Egypt. The idols of Egypt tremble before him, and the hearts of the Egyptians melt with fear." Now, here are the mighty gods of Egypt, these long-established gods in the land of Egypt. And we're reading that when God comes, when this force comes down, that they're going to tremble in fear. You know that moment when you first realize that whatever it is you've been trusting in is not going to be enough? That you are the guy with a knife at a gunfight? That all the money you have accumulated to protect you and yourself, that all your money's not going to buy your health? That all of your health won't bring back your family or give you a great family? And that all of your family won't, having all of your family there won't change the fact that you, or perhaps some of these people you love, are living apart from God? That whatever it is you've been trusting in cannot ultimately bring you victory? It's that feeling of helplessness or hopelessness, and that's exactly what the Egyptian worshipers are facing when they realize that their gods are not going to protect them from whatever it is that is coming. That in fact, these idols were just worthless pieces of metal and wood, incapable of withstanding the forces that were coming against them. So God says, if you're trusting in Egypt because their gods are powerful, because of the strength of their religion, their gods can't save you. Their gods are incapable of protecting you. So God says, don't trust in the Egyptians' religion. But what about their vast resources, right? What about that cash cow, the Nile River? And this is what we read in verses 5 and 6. "The waters of the river will dry up, and the riverbed will be parched and dry. The canals will stink. The streams of Egypt will dwindle and dry up." Now, it's tough for us to imagine because we live in a land that gets pretty regular rain. We've got ready sources of water nearby. But in Egypt, without the Nile River, there is no Egypt. That was it. There is virtually no rain in this desert region. So they are completely dependent upon the Nile for irrigation for all of their crops. There are no tributaries in the Nile for the last 1,000 miles. That means that it floods on an extremely regular basis. The floods come the same week every year. The floods recede the same week every year. And so it brings in not only the water, but all the nutrients for the soil. It is everything in the Egyptian economy, everything in the Egyptian life is built around the Nile River. And if there's one thing you can count on, it is the Nile. But then you can't. It's like having your one big annual paycheck ripped out from under you. You know, at first it might not be that bad. Maybe you've saved up some, you've got some reserves, and you can maintain a similar lifestyle, but then it gets harder and harder and harder. And you start looking around and thinking, well, what can I sell? What can I get rid of here? Resources are a great thing to depend on until you realize just how transient those resources are, how fickle, how unreliable, that it doesn't matter how much you have or how much you think you're going to have, that those resources can disappear and dry up just like that. And so when your resources are entirely dependent on one river, God says, that's nothing. So don't depend on Egypt for their vast resources. And finally, look at verse 13. The officials of Zoan have become fools. The leaders of Memphis are deceived. The cornerstones of her people have led Egypt astray. Now, the Egyptians are renowned for having wisdom and learning. They are a learned bunch. It is a great center for education and knowledge, which would make you think they're, again, worth teaming up with. They've got all these really smart people. Who should we get advice from? We'll go down to Egypt, right? They've got all these smart guys down there. And I get that. I've been in school, I think I counted up, for 29 of my 44 years on this earth. I know, stupid, right? And we stress to our kids the importance of education. My wife has given her life to education. But all of the learning in the world doesn't mean you're going to make good decisions. We frequently see that the wisdom of God's ways are hidden from the smartest people around. And in this case, what he's saying is God's wisdom in this whole plan, these smart people down in Egypt, they're going to make the wrong decisions. They're going to lead Egypt astray. Their religion was no good. Their resources was no good. And their reason was no good either. Egypt, it would appear, is down for the count. They've got nothing going for them now. All the things, all the reasons you thought you should trust in them, all of those are gone. Skip ahead a few hundred years. Remember the story of Jesus gathering for the Passover meal with his closest friends? And everything looked like it's going to be according to plan. They've come to Jerusalem for the Passover. They gather together, they eat, they talk, they share the meal. And he goes out to pray later that night, and what happens? Well, an angry mob arrives to arrest him. I mean, it's got everything but pitchforks and torches. And it turns out that one of the inner circle of Jesus' followers, one of the 12, has turned out to be a traitor. Right? Now, Jesus is not guilty of breaking any laws. No one seems to be able to find anything that will stick to him, no charge. But they're not going to let a little thing like justice stand in the way of Jesus' sham of a trial. So he's beaten, he's rejected, and he's exhausted as he climbs the hill to his death. Where's Jesus' family? Where's his Jesus' friend? And remember that over his lifetime, he has served thousands and thousands of people. He has loved and lived side by side with hundreds of people. And out of all those people, Jesus sees a scant handful at the cross, his mother being one of them. And by the time he dies, he's even calling out to the Father, "Why have you forsaken me too?" He's got no money to call his own, so he has to be buried in a borrowed grave. Jesus, it would appear, is down for the count too. And maybe you've been there. Maybe you are there, like right now you're there. And things have been going along smoothly here for a while, and then wham, you know, just we'd say life happens. Everything you thought was stable, everything you thought was dependable, suddenly turns to water beneath your feet. And you wish you had it to do over again, but you don't. You wish you could do something, or you wish that someone would sort of just take this burden off of you, but they can't. It's not there. That help is not there. It's not coming. And you wish you could make a comeback. But that's too much to hope for. But then, just as you're just getting ready to throw in the towel, so to speak, resigning yourself to life as it almost was, word comes down. Jesus is gone. Not gone as in dead. Gone as in we don't know where the body is. And crazy as it sounds, Some of the women from this inner group have come back from his grave in hysterics, claiming they've seen an angel. Mary says she's even talked to Jesus himself, none of which is believable, mind you, but that's what's going on. And so you can imagine the looks on the people's faces when suddenly he appears in the middle of the room. Surely this is a cruel trick. Surely we are having a mass hallucination. Surely this cannot be true. But it is. It is a real, live, greatest ever comeback. And this morning you're thinking, well, that sounds all well and good because it happens to Jesus. But you and I know differently. You are not Jesus and neither am I, right? No one's confusing me with Jesus. We're more like the Egyptians. We're like the ones who are without a prayer. But then Isaiah says something about an altar for God being set up right in Egypt. And that some of the Egyptians will abandon their gods and begin praying to Yahweh. And then, unlike their own gods, Yahweh God says something about answering their prayers, about rescuing them, the Egyptians. And this is what it says, in that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth. The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance. Egypt and Assyria, right along with Israel? But what about all they've done? You know, what about the idols? What about keeping God's people in slavery? What about the judgments of God? What about all the killing? What about all the injustice? What about all that they have done and lived through and completed in this world that was just horrific? In verse 22, we read, the Lord will strike Egypt. And that sounds great to us because they sure deserve it. But then continue reading, it says, with a plague, he will strike them and heal them. They will turn to the Lord, and he will respond to their pleas and heal them. All their pain, all of their suffering, all of their toil, all of their turmoil, all brought down by God in order to eventually do this. Everything bad they have suffered, all so that God could do this with them. The same way Jesus had to be rejected and suffer and die before his glorious resurrection. God has engineered this whole scenario for their comeback, for Israel's eventual comeback, for Jesus' comeback, for your comeback. This was all done so that you could come back. And it is hard to fathom that. Because we look at all the bad stuff that we go through, and some of which is our own fault. But we look at that and we think, how could anything good come out of this? How could anything come out of Egypt's idolatry? How could anything good come out of Assyria's brutality? How could anything good come out of the murder of the Son of God? And so despite what you've done or how desperate your circumstances or your situation may seem, God, you can rest assured, has a plan to bring you back. And not just from the grave, though that will be great one day. Not just so that you can live in heaven forever, though that will be great one day. What we struggle with is not so much that I might live again, but believing that I might live now. That God has a plan for you in this life. That he will work on you and in you and through you right here and right now. Brothers and sisters, I want you to know that wherever you are this morning, God wants to work on you and in you to bring you back. And if we can offer prayers for encouragement, for strength, for direction, for healing, for courage, I don't know what you're going through, but we want you to know that as a part of this family, and more importantly, as a part of God's family, we are entitled to come to him to meet the desires of his will. And if it is God's will for our lives, far be it from us to stand in the way. If we can help you at all, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?